Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 851. This episode is brought to you by Loot Crate, which is a monthly subscription box service for epic gear and gaming items and pop culture stuff. It's less than $20 a month. You're going to get 6 to 8 items. It's licensed gear. It's apparel. It's collectibles. They're essentially unique, one-of-a-kind items that if you listen to this podcast, you are probably in your wheelhouse. I'm just going to go on a limb and say that. Loot Crate is like a friend who knows what you love and then surprises you because you forget. Once you just kind of put it on subscribe and it just runs in the background of your life and then it's like, oh, I got the box. Oh, that's right. It will legitimately brighten a shitty day. Will be turned around like that because you get this Loot Crate box full of stuff for yourself to play with. So you have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific each month to subscribe. And then when the cutoff happens, that is it. It's over. And you get the next month. Then you could subscribe to the next month. But make sure to head to lootcrate.com/Nerdist. Enter the code Nerdist for 10% off any new subscription, whether you're in the United States, Canada, Australia, the UK. There's more info on their site. So thanks so much to Loot Crate for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. I have something for the Nerdist Community Corkboard.
Yeah?
Next week. What's the date today, Katie?
Today is the 6th.
So the week of February 13th at midnight. Live every night.
Every night.
Live.
That's terrifying.
13, 14, 15, 16th. I know. Well, you know, initially we pitched the show. We wanted to do the show live initially.
Yeah.
So we're like, what a great live at midnight. Anything can happen. And I'm glad we didn't because we got 500 plus episodes to like really understand how the show works. But our election special was live and it was really, it went really great. And so we talked to Comedy Central and they said, well, you can do live whenever you want. So we're going to,
awesome.
We're going to go do live for this week and just see what it's like, see how it feels. So there will be stuff that we'll be incorporating people as the show is happening. We'll be incorporating stuff from social media as it's happening and people can play along.
Oh, people are going to love that.
I hope so.
That's going to be cool.
I hope so. On election night, we did a thing where there was like an electoral points. Where people could, you know, put a hashtag and then if, you know, they could essentially vote for whichever comic they wanted to, then they got more points based on that. So we're going to just be incorporating and, you know, there's no other fucking live comedy show on in late night at midnight. Still fucking innovating at 11:30. Sorry, did I get very upset just there? I got very upset just there. Katie Levine, what do you have in the Nerds Community Corkboard?
I got a couple cool things. This guy wrote in and he said he's producing a play in Seattle called Through the Plot Hole. It's written by his friend Micah Calding. And he really thinks that Nerdist listeners would like it. It's a quirky, original fantasy that, in its simplest terms, is a combination of Inception and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So that sounds really fun. It's going to be in Seattle at the Slate Theater in the Inscape building at 815 Seattle Boulevard from February 3rd to 11th. So it's going on right now. You can find more info by going to their Facebook page and just searching Through the Plot Hole, and it'll have links to tickets there and everything. And so, yeah, definitely check that out. I think that could be really fun.
Sounds like the address sounds like a fake address. They're like, it's in Seattle. Yeah, what's the address? 815. Yeah, Seattle Street. Yeah, Seattle Street. okay.
And another thing, this guy guy wrote in and he's like, and he says, I just want to get the word out on a small Australian company that he discovered called Burley Fellow. Their primary, it's the most Australian name. Their primary business is crafted men's grooming products, but the backbone of the company is to use its sales and reach to support men's mental health.
That's really nice what I guess.
I know. Burley Fellow. It's so Australian.
That's fucking great.
But yeah, they use their the products as a way to raise money and awareness for depression and anxiety disorders among men and support a bunch of organizations. So you can find them at burleyfellow.com. And this is Jeremy from Arizona that wrote it.
I wasn't going to laugh, and then you said it again. I support what they're doing. I just the name makes me giggle.
But I think that's great. I love that.
Say it one more time.
Burley Fellow.
I snorted. This episode is Keanu Reeves back on the podcast. You know, the first time Keanu came on, we only had a half hour with him. I think it's the shortest podcast in Nerdist podcast history in all 851 episodes. But this time, he was kind enough to give us an entire hour.
He was great.
He was great. And I always feel bad, you know, when we go in and when we get people during their junket day. Because it's
it's a long day.
You know, you go to this, we were at the London Hotel, so it's like you show up at a hotel like this, or sometimes it's the Four Seasons, and the whole floor is just dedicated to press, and they just take them in, the actors in, one room after another, and, you know, they just ask them a lot of the same questions, and it's just drag them around, and, you know, it's...
But we don't ask them all the same questions.
Well, no, because we have a full hour to talk to people. We get to cover a lot of these things, so it's just... I just to try to get someone to go, okay, you can just relax and have a conversation now. And he was great.
Yeah.
But I always feel bad for them in those moments. And I always feel like, I'm sorry we're here at your junket day. And I'm not just asking you. I'm not trying to get sound bites.
Yeah.
I'm not doing sound bites. Fuck sound bites. So John Wick 2, which is as fucking great as you are expecting it to be. We watched it the night before. He came on, and it's just fun. It's just a fucking video game.
All the videos of him doing the training that like went around the internet were so cool. Like, he looked so good.
There's some great long shots of just the physics of the blood spatter. Everything about it is great. So there aren't. Should we give like a spoiler warning? It's not really a spoiler. There's one thing that happened in the first movie that doesn't happen in the second movie. And we mention it in this one. I don't think it's enough to ruin the movie for you or anything. I think it's going to be difficult to take it out because it just leads to so much other conversation, you know?
No, I think if anything, it'll make more people want to go see it.
Yeah, so John Wick Chapter 2 in theaters this Friday. Go see it. Keanu Reeves still making great movies in the year 2017. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Not all ingredients are equal. There are fresh, high-quality ingredients. They make a difference, Katie.
They do. They taste better. They taste better.
That really hurt my fist. I think I need Blue Apron so I can have healthier food so my fist won't hurt when I pound it against the table in anger at how much crappy quality food is in the world when Blue Apron makes such fantastic... They just... It's great. I got it from my mom, too, who loves it.
Yeah.
She fucking loves it. Because you get the ingredients, and then you just make it. Because she particularly just likes to make stuff.
Dude, cooking is so much fun.
I've done the ones where they make the meal, and then you got to stick it in the microwave, and I don't know. It's not as rewarding.
But it is. You feel like you earned this meal.
You earned it. The only difference is you don't have to go to the store. So for less than $10 per person per meal, which is way cheaper than eating out, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients, courtesy of over 150 local farms, ranches, fisheries across the United States, right to your door, and they ship the exact amount of the ingredient that's needed for the recipe. So if you work all day and you come home and you're tired and you're like, I have just enough energy to make some food. I mean, it's tempting when you're busy. Believe me, I understand when you're busy. You just want to just fucking drive through someplace and jam a cheeseburger in your face. But take a little bit of time. It's worth it. You'll have more energy. You'll feel better. You'll feel like you did something. It's less, in 40 minutes or less, You'll have a home-cooked meal, and you'll have eaten, and you'll feel great. Some upcoming meals in February include cashew chicken stir-fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice, udon noodle soup, miso and soft-boiled eggs, roasted pork with apple walnut, farro salad, and crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. So these are really these are not run-of-the-mill food delivery service foods. They're fresh ingredients. Go to blueapron.com/nerdist. Check out the menu. Get your first three meals free with that code and free shipping. So thanks to Blue Apron for sponsoring this episode of Nerdist Podcast. BlueApron.com/Nerdist. And here's Nerdist Podcast number 851 with Keanu Reeves. Back on the Nerdist Podcast. Katie, would you please roll this thing?
Now entering Nerdist.com.
That's good.
A day where everyone gets very inquisitive.
Yeah.
Usually about the thing you're doing.
Which is okay, you know. It's putting up posters, you know. You want people to know about the show you're putting on. And
yeah. So. I know, but it's a whole separate... I always ask everyone about it on these junket days because... You know, when you first start out in the business, I don't think anyone ever thinks, I wonder, I should practice press day. You know, it's like, oh, you learn acting, you go to acting classes.
I don't think they're doing that in Yale.
They're not. And they should.
They should be doing the press day. But maybe that's, I mean, I know for me way back when, 35 years ago, you know, going through that junket experience was definitely, I like, you know, I had done publicity and you know, and I know that you're putting on a play, you're putting on a show, right? The players are coming to town.
Right.
So fundamentally, I was completely on board, but the experience was definitely in the beginning shocking. Yeah.
Did anyone give you, what was it for, like Razor's Edge or something? What was it?
Let's see, which was the one? I mean, the one that pops out in my head is the first time that I went to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. For Point Break.
Got it. Oh, wow. That far in.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah. Yeah.
What was it? Just the same? Was it?
Well, number one, it was a culture. I'd never been to Japan. And I guess, let's see, in America, yeah, some of the, like, the Toronto Film Festival, you know, doing some junkets there and press interviews and stuff. Definitely. Yeah.
To me, it seems like it seems maddening now because we're in such a culture of editorial content demands where it's like every site has to put up 20 things, 50 things a day, and everyone's just looking for some little angle. And it's like if you say anything that's even that someone could rip out of context and make the press today is so terrifying to me.
The ye old rip out of context, an oldie but a goodie.
But the problem with today's modern ripping out of context is that at least I would imagine at least tabloids, you know, in the 80s, you know, there were only a few of them. Now it's like if one person gets something, then it's...
Well, there was always gossip, right?
Right.
There was always gossip and, you know, the photographers waiting outside the hotel and all of those things. So it's, again, it's classic.
Well, how do you, you know, so when you're a young kid and, you know, you're coming out of a hotel and there's a million photographers and you're not used to that, do you think, oh, this is awesome or what the fuck is happening? Or is it...
The latter. Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm, you know, you want to have a, you hope to be able to have a kind of separation of public and private and you know, not necessarily have people intruding on, you know, your private life. But on the other hand, it is cool when you get to meet folks who've seen what you've done and like what you do and, you know, give an autograph or take a photo or, you know, so that's, I'm good with all that, but yeah, nah, yeah, but the peering through the hotel window or I'm going to take your picture while you're filling your motorcycle up with gas.
And then it'll be at the, they're just like us.
They're just stars like us.
Yeah, they're human
we
beings.
Are,
who have
we
to...
are, though. We are human beings until you don't want us to be.
Exactly.
And then it's a shit show.
Well, that's the thing is that so many people really have this impression of you and people in, you know, who are in the entertainment as a two-dimensional thing. It's like, oh, I see you in two dimensions, basically. I don't,
right?
And they don't really see. They don't. They. It's almost like,
which is fine.
Yeah. Is it? Is it okay?
I mean, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not. Is it fine? Wait, I have to stop for a second. Is that fine?
It's part of the deal.
The old part of the deal. Another oldie, but a goodie.
Yes.
You wouldn't be famous unless I was a paparazzi taking your picture, filling your motorcycle up with.
Exactly.
Gas. You owe your career to me. Well, what about the film I did?
Oh, yeah, that too. But you know, this is definitely because of this picture you filled out your motorcycle.
You wouldn't be famous.
I love that you ride motorcycles because it seems. I was in San Francisco over the weekend. I was walking by a motorcycle shop and I went in and they had these amazing Triumph motorcycles. Mm. I'm terrified of motorcycles. I'm flimsy by nature. And so I just think of myself like getting on it at the shop. Thanks a lot, guys. Vroom, like right into a post. Yeah, exactly. So was motorcycling like a lifelong pursuit for you, or was it something that you did later?
I always wanted to ride a motorcycle as a kid, but I didn't really have the culture around me. Like, I didn't have any friends who rode motorcycles. And then when I moved to Los Angeles in 85, and I was 20, and then I was older, and I was like, what are some things I want to do? And it was like, I want to ride a motorcycle. So I ended up learning how to ride a motorcycle and then getting a bike, and then that journey started, which, you know, in Los Angeles is amazing, right? Sunset Boulevard to the PCH into the Santa
Monica. Potholes, traffic, people not paying attention to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Bus and buses that don't give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, that oil in the road. Oil,
yeah, exactly. A little bit of drizzle and the whole city shuts down.
And you're sliding. And then, of course, don't forget about, you know, the choices that you make.
Of course.
Like, maybe I shouldn't be at that high rate of speed. With all of those shots of tequila. But it feels so good. I mean, there's nothing. Anyway, I'm not going to.
Do your agents ever say, like, maybe please don't ride your motorcycle anywhere? Could you not
no.
do that?
I mean, when you start a project, there are some agreements that you have to sign.
Sure.
You know, like, you will not ride your bike or jump out of airplanes or none of those kinds
only
of things.
If you're John Wick.
No, I mean, any, you know, I mean, you, part of your, you know, you get a health exam, you know, you have to go to the doctor and get checked out, and part of when they do that on that document, I agree not to. And
but they make you do everything in the movie, like,
oh, well, that's okay because that's, you know,
yeah,
you know, professionally
that's
supervised.
Under insurance. Yeah. It seems like my wife and I watched the movie last night. It's fucking great.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
And I mean, I'll probably cut this part out because this is a spoiler, but we were real relieved that the dog didn't fucking die again. There was like, when the house blows up, I'm like, not fucking again.
No.
And then he comes up and licks your face. And that was almost like your way of saying, like, we're not going to do that again.
You don't have to. You can't kill a dog again.
You can't. It was so important the first time. I completely, you know, the movie itself, the first movie too, really spiritually is kind of John Wick. The movie itself is almost the character of John Wick, right?
Wow.
It's,
yes.
It's violent when it needs to be, but there's a code and it's efficient and it just gets in and it gets out and it's like,
yes.
It's fucking great. But I just loved so much. We're going to give it for the audience. We're going to give you every reason why it's okay that this man murders like 100 people. And you're going to be, not only are you going to be okay with it, you're going to wish he killed more people.
Just like, there's no end.
There's
no end to the revenge.
There's no end at all.
No. Yeah, we definitely, I think from that premise, we kind of, you hand that off to that guy. And I like what you're saying, that the film is the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, that definitely continues in the second part of the chapter. You know, the film takes place 5 days later. And, you know, the first thing he does is he's going to go get his car that was stolen, you know. And he's trying to reclaim his life, you know. And stuff happens.
Some things happen. But there is this recurring theme, which, you know, as someone who's really started to address mortality in my mid-40s.
How old are you now?
45. Yeah. It's like, oh, wow, can you go back? Can you, you know, because it's just this life in particular is never going to let this guy ever make another choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's choices, it's rules, which, you know, John abides by.
Right.
But they're starting to kind of crimp on his stock. Like, they're kind of starting to become conflicts with the life that he wants to lead, and the choices that he's made in the past are coming back to collect.
I mean, it's comical to me that I feel so much empathy for a guy, and it's like, and he picks up and it's a picture of his wife, and he has that moment, you're like, God, I feel so bad for him. And he literally just killed like 30 people. And you're
well,
like, wow.
Well, it's not just 30 people.
They're 30 horrible people.
They're 30 arch-villains.
They're arch-villains.
In the underworld. And they got a job to do, and, you know, that's what's happening.
They won't let the fucking guy.
Right, let's leave me alone.
He just wants to go home with his dog.
He just wants to hang out. He wants to grieve. I mean, that's what we're playing with, that expanding that kind of idea that there's John and John Wick.
Right.
And in this picture, you know, John Wick is fighting for John.
Right.
You know, John, the widow, John, the guy who doesn't want to live in the world anymore, of the underworld, who gets, you know, he has a choice, either do what he's kind of bound to do to pay back a debt or die.
Right.
You know, so John Wick takes over and he's like, yeah, I get it, but there's a price to pay, you know, and in a weird way, John Wick keeps digging a deeper hole for John.
Right.
You know, so it's that conundrum of like, I want my agency, a self-agency, but in order to achieve it, I'm compromising any possibility of that actually ever happening.
Right.
So it's delicious.
Well, and you mentioned
dramatically delicious.
I mean this as a tremendous compliment, but one of the reasons why I love the second movie is because it almost feels like Harry Potter for assassins. You know, there's like this whole world that the rest of humanity doesn't see.
Yeah.
And there's this whole like magical world of, you know, like assassins. And this whole
the high table gets introduced.
Yes,
the clan.
Yes, yes.
All of that kind of the clans of darkness.
And John Wick is kind of the chosen one. And I mean, like, I feel like a lot of your characters are sort of like the chosen, you know, there's like Neo and John.
Right.
It's like all these characters.
Constantine.
There was a really great question on Reddit today where someone said, if any actor could assemble all of their characters from films, who would have the strongest army? Like, oh shit, that's a really good.
Stallone
maybe, but he doesn't really.
Schwarzenegger?
With the exception of Judge Dredd, they don't really play. You know, Schwarzenegger played was in one superhero movie,
right?
You know, but actually, your name, you were at the top of the list, and
really?
It just listed all of the It listed every, you know, from Speed, and then Johnny
what about
Utah.
Clint Eastwood?
But he just, you know, he plays like a gunslinger and like a bare knuckle boxers, you know,
right.
and then cranky old racist guy, you know,
right?
It's like, I don't know if Get Off My Lawn is that threatening as an army.
No.
but I kind of feel like. You know, do you think you would have a formidable army as with all of your,
like, all of the cats I play?
All the cats, yeah.
I wouldn't mess with them. I don't know if they'd come marching in trying to, like, they're all kind of reactive, aren't they?
Very reactive.
They're not really looking to take what's yours.
No.
They're kind of trying to keep what's theirs.
It's guys who are just like, fuck, just let me live my life. Maybe I made some dumb choices in my 20s, but for fuck's sake.
Just, like, get over it. You know what I mean? Heaven and Hell, John Constantine. Wow, you know, this was brought up to me, too, is like, how many Johns have I played?
I noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know the number. Johnny. I think there might be 6 or 7. I don't know.
But I think what...
I've got an army of John. Sounds almost punk rock,
It is
right?
a little punk rock. Army of Johns.
Army of Johns.
New band? Army
New
of Johns?
New band. It's a band name.
Army of Johns. Yeah. Actually, I know we're joking around, but I think you should seriously consider it. I think you should seriously...
1, 2, 3, 4! I am John. I am John. I am John.
John, I'm John. But what's great about it is that it... I think a lot of your characters do sort of represent the, like, they're sort of aspirational in that way of like, oh, that guy could be anybody.
Right.
You know, he's right. John, like, he's this very, in one part of his life, he's this very sort of invisible, generic guy. And certainly in The Matrix, he was that guy in the
right,
beginning.
Sure.
And, but it's this untapped potential that he has, like, as right. the everyman, he can be like
the extraordinary,
the Uberman,
but through the struggle.
Right.
Right? Through the fight, through the discovery.
Yeah, all your guys have to go through a lot of shit.
They got
to
get... Yeah, I know. Chad Stahelski, the director of Chapter 2 here, he kind of delights in just crushing John Wick. You know, he gets hit by cars and thrown through windows and beat up and shot, which is... It's kind of funny. He's like, yeah, I like just, you know... fucking with that guy. Which is fun because it's, you know, you get that kind of will and, you know, you get to get knocked down and, you know, brush it off and live to fight another day.
Yeah, but part of it really is, you know, someone told me that the number of moves that you can do in a single take is kind of legendary in fight training and stunt circles, because they're like, yeah, the amazing thing about Keanu is that he's like a lot of performers, like, okay, 1, 2, maybe 3 moves in,
right,
and they got
right.
a point. Like, but the amount of focus
14.
That you have, the amount of focus, you know, the number, yeah.
I don't know, I'm making that up.
But the amount, let's just say it's 14.
Okay. You know, that doesn't sound, let's say, that, well, if we're going to do that.
Okay, yeah.
38.
38 is great. Any blog could pick that up and just report it as news, and it's fine. That's what happens now.
New reality.
It's a new reality, yeah. As long as you say it and they can source it, it doesn't fucking matter.
It's called a new fact.
It is a new fact. It's an alternative fact. But, which apparently are as redeemable as regular
no,
facts.
They're the same.
Yeah, they're exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
It's like paying for groceries with like McDonald's dollars or something. It doesn't matter.
It's a dollar.
It's a dollar. What
it's
are you talking
something.
About? Yeah, somewhere it has value. Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be here, but it doesn't matter.
New fact.
But it's just that amount of focus.
You know, I've benefited from a lot of training and a lot of great teachers, and definitely when you go into John Wick, you know, there's training, because you can fake a fake punch. I mean, like, you know, throwing a punch and then someone faking to get hit. But it's a little different when you're doing a judo throw, and a little different in the jiu-jitsu. And then also with the gun work, they wanted to give me the opportunity to do a lot of gun training, target shooting, and just to get to, you know, to be able to be comfortable with the weapons and to be real with them. You know, like, yeah, that guy can do that.
Yeah.
And which I think is part of the fun of watching the movie, because you kind of get connected to the character. You're watching him go through these fights and to do these things. And so for me, as a performer, it's fun to be able to be there to create that connection to hopefully the enjoyment of the film. So that's the raison d'etre.
Whoa, that's very fancy. Where do you find these guys, especially when so much of the movie is this character is being defined by how hard he can kill the shit out of everyone. And there are some amazing, like, video game grade sequences,
yes.
especially like in the catacombs,
stylized,
running through the tunnels.
Yeah.
And so my wife loves that stuff too.
Oh,
she
really?
Likes
cool.
Fight training. And just the angles of the shot, so you can see like the blood spatter against the rocks and everything.
Oh my!
But
yes.
The
director loves that stuff. I mean, every shot, every explosion, every bullet hit, every, you know, there has the math has to be right.
Right.
You know, there's the math is right.
So when you, I guess it's sort of the difference between the technical aspect of making sure that, you know, everyone dies and everyone, John Wick goes in to do what he's supposed to do. But then how do you as a performer go, okay, well, where are we going to find this guy's humanity? You know, like we know that he is an unstoppable killing machine.
Right.
We know he's this boogeyman character that cannot
be stopped.
But he's
fleeing. He's fighting. Again, I think it's the reactive aspect of it. The humanity is that he's fighting for his life.
Yeah.
Right? And I think also with the context of the world, there's like an agreement, right? Yeah, like he's being chased. They're shooting at him. Okay, they're shooting at him because in the previous scene, I might have, you know, killed someone.
but you had no choice.
But I had no choice. you know, and maybe I wasn't quite, you know. But then, you know, someone puts a contract out on me, and I'm fighting for my life again. Yeah, so hopefully you root for the guy. Hopefully you root for John Wick. I mean, I root for him. I feel bad for the guy.
Yeah.
You know? Lost his wife. They killed his dog.
They did. Yeah, I know.
He just wants to retire. He wants to, like, hang out. Maybe he's going to go fishing. I don't know.
I feel
start
like...
woodworking. I don't know. Restore books. You know,
I do kind of wonder. There's places where my brain goes, like, okay, so what if John... Because the way that this movie ends, it seems like, well, there has to be a third one. I mean...
Right.
But... But I think a guy like that, I just wonder, I get too real with it. I'm like, well, how would he process all of that? I mean, at a certain point, especially as you get older and you get more reflective and, you know, do you think it's even possible for him to process like everything that he's experienced?
I think the character definitely has some stuff to work out and he might need to seek some, you know, a professional healthcare worker. but right now he's a little busy.
Yeah.
And, you know, does he have a little post? I mean, yeah, we kind of get into that. You know, a character asks him, you know, do you believe in hell? You know, and he's like, yeah. You know, I think that there is, I mean, it's not explored, but I think it's in the fabric and kind of emanates from the character that, that he knows who he is and what he's done and where that might be morally and ethically.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah.
Is it silly to ask?
But in the context of where we see him,
yeah.
I think that, because they talk about missions or like the impossible task that he had to do in order to get out in the first place. I don't know. I mean, I feel like when we see him that there is a kind of, he's not a bad guy. He's not, you know, there's, again, I just go back to fighting for his life, but that's not enough. I don't know. I don't think he's a bad man.
Right. But I guess you as the performer can't really ever think any of your characters are bad. I mean,
not that guy.
You're not
I'm
that
not
guy.
Like, you have to fall in love with the villain. And, you know, they're not bad people. And, like, no, man, he's bad. Enjoy it.
Okay,
you
good.
Know?
Good.
Yeah. No. Come on.
But you don't really play.
I've played a few villains.
Do you have a favorite?
That I've played?
Yeah.
You know, like all my children, I love them all. I don't know. I mean, I played a kind of a villain, a character named Donnie Barksdale in Sam Raimi's film, The Gift.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this English-Chinese kung fu movie called Man of Tai Chi, and I played the villain in that. And he was delicious. I mean, he just was interested in corrupting an innocent soul and interested in death. And yeah, that was fun. Because he was a little more fantastical.
Right.
You know, Donnie Barksdale was an awful wife-beating fucking asshole.
Right.
So, you know... It was okay to play him, but he was a jerk.
Do you ever, you know, after a movie like that or after a movie like John Wick, do you ever go, hey, maybe I just want to play a movie, maybe I'm just a character who just doesn't really get out of bed very much and is just on a cruise ship most of the time.
Do you have a coma movie? Maybe I wake up from a coma and I'm just in bed. Wait. Can I be the king of something?
Yeah.
Can and I maybe just... there's, yeah, I have servants.
A bunch of other people just run around and you kill that guy.
Yeah,
I'm tired.
Yeah. In Tahiti?
Or
south of France,
or a real low stakes romantic comedy or something.
There is no low stakes in romance.
I get that's true in real life, but in romantic comedy,
that's right.
He's an accountant. She's a fortune teller. And how do they?
It's wacky.
It's wacky.
How do they fit?
How do they? He likes his forks in this drawer, and she leaves her pants on the floor. You know?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, come on. You must feel some relief. I mean, I suspect that you probably love the grind, though. You probably seem to...
I am a grinder.
You enjoy the grind of, like, let's fucking get into this and let's parse it out.
Well,
and
why
focus.
Else would you do it, man?
Yeah.
And then that's true of doing the fortune teller and what was the other person's...
I think he was an accountant.
And the accountant or something like that. Yeah, I mean, digging into the characters and into the story and dedicating and committing to... the work and telling the story is the pleasure. But I do also, in terms of action, love the physical side of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the training and I like, you know, trying to achieve super perfect in an action sequence. And it might be my Virgo-ness coming out,
Sure.
So I would be that guy, like my socks that way. You know,
right.
You know.
Well, it just seems like
I'm a fortune teller.
You'd be the fortune teller,
yeah,
and
right.
the other person would be the accountant. That's how that would play out. But it just seems like there's so much focus in everything, such a tremendous amount of focus. And do you ever sort of feel that hey, maybe I don't need to do this for a while? Because everything you do ever since I first started seeing you, I'm not that much younger than you are. It seems like you kind of just do whatever you feel like you want to do. Big movies, small movies, main characters, not main characters. It just seems like, you know, or like for Key and Peele's movie, like, oh, I'll just do the voice. You know,
Voice.
Why not?
I'm the cat.
You're the cat. So why not? I mean, that's a very specific type of a mindset that seems to operate kind of just on their own wavelength.
Right. You know, it's always been my hope to try and do, you know, different genres, different scales of films, different kinds of stories. And I mean, I enjoy what I do, and I like doing weird shit and hopefully creating worlds and popular work. And you know, this for me, it's really the material and who you're working with.
Yeah.
And that's for like, if something's coming to me, and in terms of like developing things, I mean, I like doing what you said, you know, playing character roles or supporting cast or leads or, you know, playing John.
Sure.
But I mean, I feel really fortunate to have been able to do that.
I mean, and it also kind of seems like it doesn't really feel like you feel like you're just kind of your own entity. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, because there are certain people I go, oh, they're a part of that scene or they're a part of that scene. It's like, oh, you just sort of operate in your own space. And that's more of a, I don't know. It feels like a little more trailblazy, but do you ever feel like, I better do this, or I should probably do this to help this? Or do you really just go, hey, this is exciting to me, I'm just going to do it because it sounds fun?
I think they're both, those are both true. Definitely there's, you know, professional considerations of like trying to, you know, in terms of the acting capacity, I'm a beggar, right? So I can't do it by myself. It's a collaboration. It's a collaborative art form. And so it's not quite like I just order it up, right? So right. I got to develop work, or I got to take meetings, but again, I'm also not saying that there aren't opportunities, right? So let's see, what's my point? I've kind of drifted adrift of a point.
Well, I think it's just how are you, you know, how do you know, or what is it that inspires you, or what is, because some of the movies, like, you know, when they're pitched to you, it's like Point Break. All right, they're surfers, but they're bank robbers. And you're like, well,
fantastic. Well, for me, I mean, specifically on that, I hadn't been in an action genre picture, right? So Catherine Bigelow, as the story's told, has just really had to fight to have me to play that role, you know?
Right.
The studio went Keanu Reeves, Johnny Utah, action movie. And Catherine went, yes. You know, and they were like, what are you thinking? And she was like, he's the guy. So thank you again, Catherine. Because that changed my life. And that's, again, where it's collaborative. You need someone to kind of put that out there. I'm adrift again. But that's, you know, that's... That
be adrift. That listen, kind of, you're gonna have to talk for like 12 hours today.
And
I always feel bad about pinning people down when they're doing a press day, because I'm sure a lot of it's like, you know, here's five questions. Here's
But I'm just. What was your question? Because
It's really just about. It's really just about, you know, selection and choices and right. How do you? What is it that excites you about something? Like what is it? Because you have.
Well, then it's like if it's cool. I mean, if it's to your taste, if it's like something that you like, you know, you like the character, you like the story, then, you know, oftentimes I'll say yes when other people are like, no, you shouldn't do that movie. You know, you know, it's too small, or the subject matter is too challenging, or, but that often happens with, I guess, if it's just a singular populist point of view.
Sure.
And maybe that's the distinction, you know.
But you must have some sort of a gut. I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, I mean, your life is essentially, everyone's life is a series of choices that they make, some good, some bad, but they sort of have to, you know, and I think everything has some type of value, even in the ones that don't work out, because you go, okay, right. I learned, if you can learn from stuff.
Right.
Then you can do better the next time, you know.
Hopefully. How's that going for you? For me, I'm like, I don't know, I'm doing okay, but I mean, I don't know. I maybe have a learning disability.
No, I think it's healthy to always think you're doing just okay. I think if you think you're nailing it too much, you're not nailing
it. You're just weird.
You're just weird. Yeah, you're not nailing it. But I think it's bad to swing too far to the other side and be like, I'm a failure. I think to think, okay, I'm doing okay.
I'm doing okay. It's healthy.
Yeah, I think it is healthy. But, you know, it's especially in this business where it takes so many people to make a thing. And then it takes so many people to make a thing good. So, like, you know, with the Matrix, when that hadn't been seen before, really, right. At least not in American cinema.
Yeah.
And so how do you, you know, when they're going, we're going to do this and it's going to look like this. And if people don't have a frame of reference, I'm sure there were people who went, well, that's never going to work. So why are you the guy that says, I know that can work?
I don't know. I really liked the script and the stories. And when I met the directors, they were fantastic. And but that's also what made them exceptional, and the studio at the time that took a chance on them. And, you know, they had proof of concept, right? So they had the script and they had some images and they had done Bullet Time. They had done like a proof of concept of Bullet Time. So there was a bunch there to say yes to, but also, you know, humans are batteries and they live in a digital world. It's like some Philip K. Dick stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I could see how someone could say, and we're going to spend how much to make that story? well, we need, you know, whatever, tens of millions.
Ten? Was that much?
How
much was that?
But they did, and God bless them all.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it was hard not to get super excited to see Lawrence Fishburne pop up in this movie.
Oh,
like, oh, there he is. Come on. There they are.
Yeah. You know, it was cool. I had seen him socially and he was saying that he really enjoyed the first one, and he kind of just not flippantly or ironically said, but you know, if there anything comes up in the second one, let me know. And I was like, I was like, as a matter of fact, Lawrence, there is. And so, Chad sent him the script and thankfully he responded to the role and then of course he came to the picture and knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, he's great.
He's that guy. He's amazing.
Do you how do you separate the I'm the producer I'm like a producer hat versus a just an actor hat?
I guess you just take them on and off quickly.
Right.
Or
I mean, you don't want, when you're in the middle of, when you have to shoot and you're in scenes, I'm sure the last thing you want is people come in and go, hey, here's some producer things you need to work out.
On this project, I'm not that guy.
Okay.
Yeah, on John Wick, I'm more of a – I'm not a credited producer.
You're so not. Okay.
I'm not. No.
I just assume on everything you do, you probably
I have a point of view, and I'll ask those questions going into the picture, you know, and I'll go into the office and check everything out and how's it looking and what are we doing and what are the resources and one, because I like it, but two, it impacts the film you're in.
Yeah.
And, you know, with John Wick 2, there's a real shorthand with the director and the producer, Basil Iwanek, and what Chad needs, what the picture needs. And so I might weigh in on that. Certainly creatively, you know, when we were coming into having the opportunity of doing Chapter 2, you know, Chad... the writer Derek Kolstad, Basil Iwanek, the producer, and myself, definitely there were meetings and definitely involved in the collaboration and the creation of the story that we tell.
How do you define, for you, what is a success? You know, is it some sort of an external thing, like, box office or the press or whatever, or is it like an internal thing? Like, I know I did a good job on this regardless of what happened.
Yeah. The latter is definitely number one, right? So that's like the work that you did it with, and the film that got made. And if I feel positive about the work that we're doing, mm-hmm. then the other things, whether the budget of it or how it's critically received, don't impact me as much in the sense of, like, you know, for me, if it's monetary, which is connected to, did people like it? You know, did they like what you do and like what you were part of? That's important, you know, because you want people to like what you're a part of and what you're doing. So if it doesn't make money, it means that no one saw it. And if you really feel strongly and love what you did, can I swear on the Nerdist?
Yeah. We've been fucking swearing like crazy.
Okay. Already. Well, then that's a fucking drag.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
So it's like, it's. And then critically, yeah, I mean, you try not to read reviews, but they creep in. One always gets like, did I leave the window open? Wait, is it back to, who left the back door? What?
How'd that press get in here?
How did that review
put this here? God damn it.
I did. And then you're like, is it going to be good? Is it going to be bad? I hope they like it, you know? But that's like the day that can be a momentary thing. But
sure.
The thing that lasts is really, my experience making it in the film that got made. Like, for me, a film that I did called Generation I think there's 8 people who have seen it, but I love that film and I love the work that's in it from myself and from the other actresses and actors and the director and everybody. So, you know, pieces like that, you're like, oh, I wish people would watch Generation. It's a nice movie. But they didn't. So it's a drag.
But you know, I think ultimately that's just an external thing that you can't control. And that can be a variety of factors of, oh, you know, it came out at a time where this happened, or it just kind of, but that doesn't mean.
Yeah.
But now with Netflix, you know, like now.
Netflix. Yeah, well, that's the thing. You do like. But that's one of the real, one of the cool things about digital exhibition and distribution that's happened over the past 8 years is that the films are having a different life, but have an opportunity being seen. And so you will get that like response of, you know, on the street, like, oh, I saw Generation Om. That was weird. And you're like, yeah, cool. You saw it? Yeah.
Do you have like a couple, like maybe 2 or 3 movies that you feel like, it, whether they were huge hits or not huge hits, but you feel like, oh, I would really like people to see these couple movies because they either, you know, represent something
Thumb
special
sucker,
for you.
Private Lives of Pippa Lee, A Scanner Darkly.
Nice.
What else we got floating out there? I don't know. I mean, the Kung Fu movie I made, Man of Tai Chi. Have you seen the documentary I did called Side by Side?
No, what's that?
Oh my God, the documentary Side by Side about the transition from photochemical film and then digital.
Oh, we're going to watch the shit out of that.
No, it's a good one.
My wife and I love that.
Oh, you do?
I love that
stuff.
Then
this is actually, it's really cool. It's directed by Chris Keneally. I produced it.
Oh, that's great.
One of the producers, Justin Slaza, produced it as well. But I had this feeling of like I was in a, oh, Henry's Crime, another nice, Vera Farmiga, James Caan, nice movie, romantic. anyway, I was working on that, I think it was 2011, and right there I was just seeing like they were doing digital color, and there was this conversation happening between the digital colorist and the photochemical colorist as we were matching photochemical film and digital. And then there were all these new digital cameras coming on. And I was like, this is the end of film. And so I started on this kind of journey for a year and a half of interviewing people about that, the end of film.
You caught that moment.
Yeah, I did. Because while we were making it, Aeroflex stopped making photochemical cameras. And Panavision, and it was really coming. The Arri Alexa was coming, and so I spoke with cinematographers and filmmakers, George Lucas, Christopher Nolan. I mean, there's a Lars von Trier, Steven Soderbergh, Robert Rodriguez. So we were really doing like the new digital. David Lynch, who had done early video. So we were really kind of going this transformation from digital video to the high-end cinema cameras, and then just the end of film. And we get into archival, and just, you know, what are we losing? What are we gaining? You know, what is the difference between a photochemical image and a digital image? And it got into digital, not really, all things digital. Really, the last piece was the digital camera that's
right.
Made it all possible, right? And so Side by Side is about that.
That's fantastic, especially because you have so much access to, you have access to people that most people do not have access to.
Yeah, that helped. I mean, we went to a film festival in Bydgoszcz in Poland. It's called Camera Image, and it's a cinematographer's film festival. It's where we started. And so basically we had a couple of guys, the director, producer, and a couple of cameramen, and we basically bum-rushed a film festival and just started like interviewing. And because I was there, you know, some of the film cinematographers I'd worked with, they'd known me, so it was safer, right?
Sure.
They would say like, oh, it's Keanu Reeves. Okay, yeah, okay, I'll take 10 minutes and talk to you. And then from that, we kind of gained a reputation. And then basically I was writing letters and contacting people's managers and agents and saying, wherever, however, whenever, we will come to you and will you interview us? We go, can I interview you?
Oh my God, that's amazing. I would imagine the first 5 minutes of any of those people would be like, oh, before we start this, who would win in a fight, Constantine or Neo? You know, like, because people are fanning out, you know,
No.
By the way, I feel like it would be Neo.
Oh, winning?
Yeah.
Constantine or Neo?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
man.
Neo's kind of a... He's within the Matrix, he's kind of a god. So I guess within the Matrix, I guess if it was just like...
Okay, well then we're choosing the venue, right? Are we in reality or are we in the digital world?
Well, I wasn't prepared to get that question,
I mean,
Keanu Reeves.
Is this home field or what's the weather like?
What's the weather like? The sun's blocked out. The humans blocked it out to defeat the machine, so they use the people as batteries. It's a terrible reality.
Right? And then Constantine puts his forearms together, starts speaking some Latin. And here come the demons. Deal with that, Neo.
All right, fine.
Thomas.
All right, fine. You take Constantine. I take Neo. It's totally fair. It's totally reasonable. I've been seeing a lot of... People seem to keep throwing the Bill and Ted question at you, and the only reason I do is because Alex Winter was just on the podcast, when he did the Dark Web documentary,
sure. And
I always bug him about that, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, we're still talking about it, but
we're still talking about it."
I still think it would, you know, whenever you decided to do it,
want to do it. We're waiting on a script, and we're waiting on these entities. We're waiting on the business side of show business to get their acts together,
right?
because it's a rights cluster fuck. So there's MGM and then this other company, STX, that's trying to do it. And
well, see, now that's really interesting to hear, because a lot of times when people, you know, people who are not in the business go, why don't you just do this thing? And it's like, okay. Usually when something doesn't happen, the answer is lawyers, you know? That's usually the problem.
Yeah, getting lawyered up.
So maybe just give people, if you can just give people a little idea of, like, with something like this or anything, what the process is, so they understand, like, it's not like we're not doing it to punish you. Like, it's just it's just a process.
Well, you know, the writers had originally, this was, I think, now 7 years ago, had come to Alex and I, and they had an idea.
Chris Matheson and Solomon?
Yes. Yeah. To tell another story. And so Alex and I was like, cool, and we riffed, and they wrote a draft. And then, so from there, we had a producer. We brought Scott Kruf on board, who was one of the original producers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like looking for a director, and then you're looking for a place to pay for it, and hopefully have distribution. And so that's MGM, and then MGM's like, no, we don't like it enough. And then this company, STX, was like, yeah, we kind of like it. We'd like to do it. And then STX and MGM have to start talking to each other.
Right.
So you get into chain of title, you get into rights. And then they start negotiating it, and they're still... and then STX wanted some different drafts, and so the writers do some different drafts, and they're doing free drafts, and then we're like, you can't do that anymore. You have to get paid, but then who's paying you? But who's going to pay them if they don't have the rights to it?
Right.
And so so that's the struggle. It becomes the business side of show business, to kind of find the funds and get the rights and pay the dough to let the creatives go.
I think that's at least that, you know, that kind of helps people understand it's never as simple as, like, they're just not doing it, you know? It's like, no, they, you know, everything, especially in films, it seems like it takes so fucking long to,
yeah,
the process.
It can be. And then there's other times where it's just like, okay, we've got the funds and we're going to go now, or we're going to beg, borrow, and steal, or we're going to leverage a credit card, you know, different levels where you can just say, fuck it, let's just go make it. But even then, you know, you've got the leveraged credit card, or you've borrowed the money. And,
yeah.
So hopefully that can get all paid back.
Netflix, 6-episode miniseries. Whatever. I mean, I don't know. I'm just, you know, sometimes things come out. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever. I don't whatever. Know. Anything.
Right?
Anything.
I don't know. Netflix, Amazon.
Netflix. Netflix is shelling out dough. I think, like, Netflix, of all entities in the world, I feel like Netflix would just go, here, just take a bunch of money. We'll make it.
Yeah.
It'd be fucking great.
No, it's cool. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, that's actually one of the things that we talk about in the documentary, is that the digital realm has really created the possibility for so many people to tell their stories, you know? And I think it's really helped with documentary. And we've also seen the impact of, you know, digital streaming and digital communication affect politics and culture. You know, people are shooting movies on mobile phones. You know, you're getting fucking 4K out of your mobile device,
yep,
which is projection quality, theatrical. So the means of production have become, but there's also the expensive version of that. But it's also impacted exhibition and distribution back to Netflix and streaming and all of the other ways to get your story told or seen.
I mean, it is a good justification for the digital culture that we live in. I also, you know, it is kind of interesting to me that there are Matrix themes that seem very applicable to now, which is people sort of building these digital facades that we live in. Like, you can create whatever truth or reality you want if you surround yourself with the right algorithms to tell you what you want to hear. And it's kind of weird, like, it's kind of strange that that's where we live now.
I know, it's crazily diabolical. And then, you know, when here comes, you know, virtual reality and, you know, VR and AR, and
yeah,
that's going to be a whole other bunch of fun and games.
I was telling someone, I think virtual reality, I was like, I feel like there will be an addiction problem with virtual reality, because why would you want to live in the real world if you could live in a perfectly idealized reality for most of the time? I mean, you'd get out to eat and pee, but other than that, you know,
yeah,
I think it's going to be a
real
problem.
That's the dark side. I mean, that was the dark side of, you know, that idea that was popularly introduced to us in The Matrix, but I mean, I was developing a TV show called User that was just about that. Like, if you can sit in your home and you can travel and you can have experiences, why go to real life? And part of that was that you would just go to real life so that you could pay for your artificial life.
You'd need to be able to fund it.
Yeah, so it was just basically junkies who were just, you know. But the other hand of that was that, like, but if you were blind, you could see.
Right.
And if you couldn't run, you could run the beach. And if you couldn't swim, if you were, you know, paralyzed, you could go, you could fly.
Right. All that stuff's great. Most people would just be like...
Don't say it. The Swedish are working on it. There's the haptic suit is coming to you very shortly. Just put this suit on, put the goggles on, put the thing with the earplugs, and away we go. And it's got AI.
And it's got AI too.
So you can have a conversation.
Yes.
And feel that the warming power of the haptic suit.
Yeah.
And you know, and you know, it's, I mean, if we're going to go there, I mean, just the neurochemistry, behavioral knowledge that is being gained and starting to interact with these new technologies, you know, virtual reality experiences basically implant into your real experience,
right.
Memory.
But and you can't really distinguish between what's real and
no,
what's
you're just going to have the same experience.
Yeah.
Distinguish, yeah. You're not going to forget that you're having VR.
But it's still going to feel.
Your brain, neurochemistry-wise, is going to be activated. Your action potentials are going
oh
to
my God.
Become enacted.
It's so dangerous.
Right?
It's so dangerous. It's going to be so fucked up.
It's so fucked up.
And we're, I think like our generation's chill. Like
no, but people would say to you, that's fucked up. But then they would give you the other side, right? So think of how you could do therapeutic psychological exercises and treatments. And
yes.
Think about, you know, the travel and experiences that you couldn't have in
of
real
course.
Life, but you could have. And
I know, of, but I just, I can't, know. I can't ignore, you know, 10,000 years of evidence that mankind will take anything good and try to put it on its dick. You know what I mean? It's like, that's what.
Or kill you with
or
it.
Or kill you with it, yeah. So it's, yes, of course, you know, it's like, you know, every great superhero movie starts out with a, oh, we did this to try to help, and then it went horribly right. wrong because.
Well, I mean, you know, if we go into like entertainment, you know, in terms of culture and, you know, is it to teach and learn and hold the mirror up to better ourselves? And artists generally try to do that,
yeah.
you know, but then there's also escapist entertainment.
Right.
Right. Where I don't want to fucking think about anything.
Right.
You know, and I want to get my synapses turned off, and I don't want to, you know, I just want to watch something and be entertained and think it's funny and all of those kinds of things.
Do you want to like direct a bunch of stuff ever? Because it seems like you love storytelling.
I do indeed, sir. Yeah, you know, I'd love to direct. I mean, I had one chance to do it, and I'd love to have the chance to do it again. Just trying to find a story. Gotta find a story to tell. Yeah.
It seems like, but just hearing you talk, I mean, you almost kind of did that with the documentary.
Yeah.
But it seems like you like this sort of, this kind of like, where are we going? Almost the singularity of it all, like the Kurzweilian, like, oh, it's, you know, we're all
Ray.
Yeah.
But Ray's an optimist, right?
You think so?
There won't be any food and there'll be no weather and we'll be in caves, but we'll be better. You know,
right.
It's all going to, I'll have a, you know, artificial arm, brain, mind thing, no cancer, everything
right.
will be eaten.
Or Black Mirror. Did you watch
Black
any
Mirror.
Of the Black Mirror?
Well, Black Mirror is like, the last season was really, I thought, I mean, I enjoy them, but I thought the confrontation of humanity and technology, I thought they were really clever and really on point and just a little bit, you know, they had digital immortality and,
yes.
you know, that choice and some of the behavioral kind of, you know, the aspect with the bees, like mm-hmm. if you could commit murder and, there's some, I think art can do that, right? That's, you know, kind of like watch out.
Right.
What's coming, you know?
So as we're kind of winding this down, Oh my God, I can't believe it. This has almost been an hour already. I hope it has not felt like an hour
to
you.
No, no, good, clean fun.
Good. No, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Well, it was so much fun the last time you were on, and it was really, you know, I just want people to come on and be comfortable and not sort of feel like they're being grilled. But particularly with someone like you, you know, I'm such a fan of what you do that I try to like mash that down a little bit. And like, we're just two guys.
Yeah, chilling out.
Just two guys on a couch in an artificial environment in a hotel in West Hollywood on a Friday morning.
Conversing, though, right?
Yeah.
Conversing.
Well, that's what's the part of one of the best things about the podcast is like, hey, these are people that I like and respect. What's it like to just talk to them like people and not, right, you know, right, like grill? So that's why a lot of the questions come from sort of,
Chris, what's happiness for you?
I don't know. It's this moment. It's this moment right now. You know what I think?
What do you hope for in 2017?
You know what? That's a great question. I think that's a great way to kind of wrap. We'll each sort of talk about what happiness is to us.
No!
I think that's good. Yeah, you have to confront it.
No!
Keanu is balled up on the couch in a fetal position.
I was joking.
Like he was told he had to do his homework. Happiness is not homework, Keanu.
No.
Happiness is not homework.
Oh, no.
You're going to school. You are going to school. I made you breakfast.
You'll see me walk out the door, but you don't know where I'm going.
I will have drones make sure you go to school. Oh, yeah. Now we can just bug kids and
Get
they go where they're going. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like tag them. Like, no, I know you didn't go to school.
It's for your safety.
I'm doing this for
your
you.
Safety.
Yeah, there is. There is. You know, that's it. But it is an interesting question. Like, what is it? Because I feel like we're so inundated with so much information at all times. And I don't think we can really process how much information we're mashing in. Good stuff, bad stuff, neutral stuff. And so lately, happiness for me has been kind of disconnecting a bit,
uh-huh,
and being okay with not having to be so...
To not know anything?
Kind of. I mean, in a way, to unplug a little bit and to sort of be, you know, in the moment and appreciate something and not be thinking about the past or the future or what someone online said or something like
right.
that. Do you agree with that, or what are chunks of happiness for you? How do you know when you're happy?
Oh, when I feel good.
Feel good.
I'm not really plugged into, for me, doing what you just spoke about would be like, but I'm going to answer those emails, but, yeah, I mean, I'm going to say some really fundamental, basic things, but I mean, you know, experiences with your friends, doing good work, you know, being involved in work. You know, I love riding motorcycles. I have a motorcycle company. Some food and shelter, a little bit of love.
Yeah. Here and there,
you know, go hang out, do some things if you can. I mean, I feel really lucky to have the resources or the opportunities to do both, you know, personally and creatively, to have a chance at things, you know.
I mean, do you give yourself that sort of reward? Like, do you wake up some days and go, hey, you know, I think I actually have been doing okay? Like, or do you go like, oh no, I still got to do this or I got to do that? Or do you kind of allow yourself to feel like, hey, you know what? I think whatever it is that I set out to do, I think I'm doing it.
I guess I'm a workaholic, and so I like to make things, you know. I do feel like I do have a ticking clock, so the mortality, the wonderful mortality punch in the face,
right,
with age happens, so. But with all that, still, yeah, you know, enjoying the simple things, but we're going to die, man.
Wait, now? No, what? No.
So.
No, you're immortal. I feel like I saw something, I don't know if it was on Reddit or something, but it was like a Keanu Reeves through the ages, and it was like a painting from 1580 that looked like you, and one funny. From like the 1700s looked like you, and it was like 84, 94, 2004, now. And you're just, you know, with the exception of different hairstyles.
Hair, lines on the face.
You look exactly the same.
Oh, man. Well, that's my ancestors then, because I certainly haven't done anything to earned to keep that keep that show going. There's no, yeah, that's definitely, you know, whoever came before me and what I inherited.
Well, what's left then? If you feel like, okay, mortality is out there, whatever, like, what's left? What is it that you feel like? Is there any point? Oh, I got to quote Parenthood, a movie that you're fantastic in, where Jason Robards goes, "You never cross the goal line. You never spike the ball." You know, like he says that to Steve Martin, and it's just like, oh, fuck. And the older you go, oh, God, there's not really a, you know. So what is it? What is it for you that you think that you got?
I don't know. I'm not quite a journey destination person, you know, but, you know, I live in a, like, what have you done lately for me business.
Sure.
So, and I also don't mind that in the way that, you know, I'm a bit of a gypsy, but I mean, you want to make good works. You want to, you know, you want to have the experience of that. You know, I love acting. I love producing, trying to help other people have a chance to tell stories. You know, I'm a part of a film called To the Bone that just got well received in Sundance. So there's a little fucking
nice. Throw,
and there's a little spike of the football there.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, that happened. So what's next?
Moment over. Now what?
Now what?
Now what happens?
Now what? You know. Yeah. So it is. There is. I mean. I guess that's a version of a beautiful bourgeois rat race. I'm in a beautiful bourgeois rat race.
Another great band. That's the album name. That's the album title for the band that we came up with earlier. Yeah. What was the band name?
I can't remember.
What
was it? The Johns.
All the Johns?
All the Johns.
All the Johns.
All the Johns.
Was it All the Johns? I think it was All
I
the Johns.
I am John, I am John.
I am John, yeah. I am John. Yeah. If you could tell, like, you know, 1985 Keanu Reeves, who just moves to Los Angeles with a fresh face and a song in his heart. If you could tell him anything, what would you say with, you know, that much runway behind you? What would you tell him?
What would I tell him to see what's coming?
Yeah, what would you say?
What
would you give him any good?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say turn around. Go back. That's definitely not
that's
happening.
That's out of the question.
I mean, do you mean like advice or warning so that I could sidestep some of the,
yeah,
the tragedy
exactly,
and mishap
exactly. Yeah.
And the pain?
Absolutely.
Or
should we sidestep pain? You know, like pain has its place.
Then, like, yeah, I can't tell him not to take that motorcycle with that crash because that's kind of, I survive, so all's well that ends well.
And who knows if that taught you something that you were able to use later. You know what I mean?
Like, right,
you
never know. Learn from your greatest enemies, your greatest teacher.
Kind of.
Your failures are the things you learn to your next success.
Yeah.
Well, these are all going in the new fact notebook. No, because, you know, they're these things because they're true. And I'm going to leave that kid alone.
Just let him make his own choices.
I'll look at him and just say, good luck, young man.
What happens? Am I going to tell you anything?
I'm not going to tell you anything, man, but good luck.
This is sort
try
of like-
not to be too awful to other people. Try not to, you know, try not to see if. But I was that guy. I am that guy, you know, so I don't know. I just wish him luck.
So there's a Bill and Ted landing in the phone booth at the Circle K and seeing slightly past Bill and Ted and telling them where you're like, oh, and this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, then that would be like, then you're like communicating some of the happy, good, clean fun that's going to happen.
Right.
You know, you have so much to look forward to, and like, it's going to be awesome. Good luck.
Well, great.
And then when that guy meets me, right, then you have that next meeting where the 85 kid gets to talk to the 2017 kid,
right?
And he's like, "So I've seen what you've done, and holy fuck, man! I mean, I know some of that great stuff that you talked about was really good, but some of that other stuff, you could have said something.
I mean, come on,
just
a little bit,
just come on,
a hint, maybe.
It's just the way it goes, man."
I wouldn't have made that sequel to Garfield in 2025. Why didn't you tell me not to do that? Well, I hope you're appreciating like what's going on, because it's great. And when I mentioned like the writer's room from one of the shows that I work on, I said, oh, Keanu's going to be on the podcast for John Wick 2. A bunch of the writers who are very cynical comedy guys were like, I fucking can't wait for that movie, you know?
That's kind.
So people are really excited about it, and it was fantastic. So
I'm glad you liked it, man. I love this picture. Love the role, and I hope people like it.
Well, thanks, man. It was great to see you. Right, and you enjoy. Would you mind ending the podcast? But we say enjoy your burrito. It's exactly what you were talking about. It means just enjoy your present. Enjoy your present.
Enjoy your burrito.
I couldn't say it any better than that.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.